now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Bad news, girls. The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
Ah!
See, a United States astral robot becomes a creature of death.
Oh. And babes.
We have come here to this planet for one purpose only, to acquire breeding stuff to repopulate our planet.
He who breaks the law shall be punished. Back to the House of Pain! Back to the House of Pain!
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-movie podcast. From classics to cults and all the cheese in between, the movies are B, but entertainment is grade A. I'm your host, Jason Giaconetti, and I'm joined here today by my dad, Al Giaconetti.
Hi, Jay. I'm glad we're doing The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. It's one of my favorite movies of all time.
Yeah, this is a classic, no doubt. This is part of the film fantasy scrapbook series we've been talking about. Last time out, we covered It Came From Beneath the Sea, which was another of Harryhausen's movies. This is actually the first one of the main set of movies. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll get right back to the action.
I say there are things better left unsolved.
Who knows what waits for us in nature's no man's land?
Impossible, unbelievable, fantastic. But I tell you, it could happen. It could happen. It could happen. It could happen.
Yes, it could happen. For various authorities believe that buried somewhere under the polar ice cap, in a state of suspended animation, are the awesome creatures, the leviathans that roamed the earth at the dawn of time. And under certain conditions, a nuclear explosion could free one from his icy tomb. Then, guided by instinct, the beast would come back to the caverns of the deepest Atlantic where it was spawned. An armored giant, wreaking his prehistoric fury on modern man and his puny machines. Cities would be terrorized by the cruel intruder from the past. Populations crazed and panicked with fear by its destructive force. Granite and steel would crumble. Soldiers and their weapons would be powerless before the onslaught of the beast. The beast. The beast. The beast from 20,000 fathoms.
Herald Square, 34th Street, Broadway. Every section of the city is guarded. No one knows where the monster will strike next.
Another one, Colonel?
No.
You know what the radioactive isotope is?
No, but if it can be loaded, I can fire it.
I'll load it. Just remember one thing. This is the only isotope of its kind this side of Oak Ridge, so you can't miss.
The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms.
The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms released June 13th, 1953, and this podcast will be dropping on June 13th, 2016, which is one of the reasons why I made sure this was here. This goes along with being one of my dad's favorite movies. This definitely wanted to be the Father's Day episode. We're dropping right around Father's Day for 2016. Okay, so The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms has a running time of about 80 minutes. It was directed by Eugene Laurie. Some of you might recognize that name from Gorgo or The Giant Behemoth. It was produced by Jack Dietz and Hal Chester. The screenplay credits go to Fred Freeburg, Eugene Laurie, Louis Moraham, and Robert Smith. Now, the original story, the short story, The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, is actually by Ray Bradbury, and was later collected, that was from the Saturday Evening Post, it was later collected as The Foghorn. Bradbury changed the name later on. The production company was originally Jack Dietz Productions, and was distributed by Warner Brothers, who actually bought the rights. The budget was about $210,000, and it grossed domestically in its first run about $2.25 million, and overall $5 million, which was pretty good money for 1953. Our story opens far north of the Arctic Circle, where Operation Experiment is being conducted. After a month of preparation, a nuclear bomb test is conducted. Right after the blast, physicist Tom Nesbitt quips, "What are the cumulative effects of all these atomic explosions? And the test will be only time will tell." The explosion releases the Retosaurus from the ice, where it has been in a state of suspended animation. The beast accidentally causes an avalanche, killing one of the scientists and leaving Nesbitt near death. Nesbitt is rushed back to the U.S. to save his life. As Nesbitt recovers, the beast begins making its way down the east coast of North America. The beast sinks a fishing catch off the Grand Banks and destroys another near Marquette, Canada. Nesbitt learns of these attacks and tracks down the survivors to verify his sightings. Nesbitt is finally able to convince the paleontologist Thurgood Elson and his young assistant Lee Hunter that he has seen a Retosaurus. As they try to get the military on board, the beast wrecks a lighthouse off the coast of Maine. The beast continues down the coast, destroying buildings along the Massachusetts coast. As the military comes to accept that they could be a connection, it appears the beast is following the Arctic current towards the Hudson River canyons. Ellison wants to capture the beast alive, but he needs to see the beast to know how. A diving bell search of the canyons has Professor Ellison and a crewman descend, where they encounter the beast. The Retosaurus attacks the diving bell, killing Dr. Ellison and the crewman, as it continues towards New York City. The beast comes ashore in Manhattan and rampages through the streets. As the beast went back towards the water, reinforcements are called in. The city is evacuated and defenses are set up. When the beast comes back ashore, it finds the city empty, except for the military waiting to attack. All the efforts are unable to stop the beast, but they're able to wound it. As the military moves in to try to finish the beast off, it is dropping pools of blood as it goes. The entire detail starts collapsing before they can find the beast. The beast is carrying a deadly disease that is spread by contact. This leads them to abandon any idea of shooting the beast with explosives, but using a radioactive isotope that would destroy the beast within, without spreading the disease. As the beast comes ashore at Coney Island, they prepare to kill the beast. It destroys a roller coaster as Corporal Stone, played by Lee Van Cleef, and Nesbitt go up in a roller coaster car to shoot the radioactive isotope from a grenade rifle into the beast's wound. As they reach the top of the track, they are eye level with the beast. The isotope is fired into the wound, and the Retosaurus lets out a horrific scream. It thrashes about, causing a fire. As the trapped beast is engulfed in flames, it finally collapses and dies. And that's The Beast, ladies and gentlemen. That's the synopsis of the movie. This is... I watched this when I was a little kid. My brother and I together, obviously, it's one of my dad's favorites. It's one of my favorites, too. My daughter loves this movie as well. The one thing I can tell you is that growing up with these kind of movies, we didn't have... Our friends didn't see these kind of movies. But to this you see here, it being a New Yorker and seeing shots in New York and stuff like that, this thing kind of hits home, just like King Kong did when we first saw that, you know, being in that stuff. Dad, what's your first experience with this film?
Well, my first experience with this film was probably on Million Dollar Movie, a WOR Channel 9 in New York station that in the mid to late 50s mm-hmm. would play the movie twice a night, once at 7:30 and then once at 10:30 at night. The first movie that I remember seeing there was King Kong, because I was just too young to obviously, when King Kong came out in the 30s, that was what my father saw. But once they showed King Kong, and we saw the dinosaurs. Any horror movie or monster movie that was coming on, we made a point to sit down at 7:30 after dinner and watch it. This movie just really, really struck me. The Rhetosaurus is one of the classic creations that Harryhausen ever made. And considering that it was done in 1953, it probably was created in 52 with all the work that he had to do, it's just an amazing, amazing stop-motion animation monster. Now, you have to remember, back in 1949, when Mighty Joe Young came out, he was the apprentice to Willis O'Brien, who had created Kong and the Son of Kong. But that movie was not well received. It was a box office flop. And as such, the call for stop motion animation to bring monsters to life on the screen were few and far between. As a matter of fact, one of the collaborations between Ray Harryhausen and Ray Bradbury was a really, really cheesy dinosaur movie called The Lost Continent. They were brought in to give an assessment as to what the price that they would charge Harryhausen to create the dinosaurs for this. And when they gave their cost figures, the producers decided to go with, and again, all I can say is watch Lost Continent, and you realize that had Harryhausen done that, it could have become a classic instead of the bomb that it is.
Yeah. It's funny, some of the early pre-production conceptual concepts of the Beast show that at one point it was supposed to have a shell head, and another point it was supposed to have a beak. Very different look, more on the gamma side of things, I guess. But the creature effects, obviously, were assigned to Harryhausen, who had worked with O'Brien, which was one of his idols, as he refers to him always as Obi. The monster of the film looks nothing like the actual brontosaurus-type creature from the short story. The creature in the film has much more of a Tyrannosaurus Rex type head because it's a predator, and that's what they say, and that's the great part. It's actually a predator in there. The drawing of the creature that was published with the Saturday Evening Post story by Bradbury definitely had more of a Brontosaurus type look. There was actually, at one point, they thought of having the Beast snorting flames, but that idea was dropped, but you can still see that in the poster. There's clearly stuff coming out of the Beast's nose. Later, the Beast nuclear breath. Some have said that led to the inspiration for Gojira's nuclear breath. There is lots and lots of debate about how much, what movies and what, you know, what helped inspire Gojira. Gojira, of course, coming out in 1954, the year later. That was later in the year. Remember, as we talked about, Them came out around, you know, the summertime as well, and Gojira followed this. It's when you look at the nuclear fallout and the movies that had monsters or dinosaurs or whatever you might have impacted by nuclear testing, this is one of the first movies to actually do that. Now, granted, the Beast is released by the nuclear testing, but it's contagion that it's carrying. It's killing people. It has that nuclear sense to it, and a lot of that points to stuff that happened in Gojira. Actually, one of the funny things, we talked about this before we started, the dinosaur skeleton in the museum is actually artificial. It was obtained from the RKO storage facility, and it was used in 1938's Bringing Up Baby, which I don't think could be any more different than this movie. It's another classic, don't get me wrong, but that's a comedy. If you haven't seen Bringing Up Baby, it is worth the time to go watch, but don't expect to see a monster. The dinosaur the dog steals the bone. That's what starts the whole thing not a lion. What is she? She has
a leopard.
A leopard. The leopard. Oh, it is a very different film than this movie, folks.
Yeah, it's with Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn, and it's considered an all-time classic comedy. Now, the thing with The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms that really got me was the story. It's done documentary style, just very similar to Them, which came out later, but it ends an air of authenticity to the proceedings that are going on. At no time is there any secondary meaning behind the story. It's a creature coming out of the Arctic, and it's terrorizing the East Coast of North America, and it literally destroys a good portion of Lower Manhattan.
Yeah.
That's it. I mean, there is a subtle love story here between Nesbitt and
Lee
and Lee, But again, it's not overt. It's just there. But it does add something to the story.
But isn't that more there just to, it gets fill in? The problem is this, and we were talking about this before. Whereas a movie like Them doesn't show you the ant for 28 minutes. You're a quarter way through the movie where you see the ant. You see the beast within the first 10 minutes. Now, granted, the beast isn't attacking anyone in the first 10 minutes. And let's be honest here. The beast is just an animal looking for food. It knocks over, it causes the avalanche that kills the other, with the other scientist, Nesbitt. It doesn't even mean to do that. It's just looking to find, it's hungry. So it just starts following the Arctic current down the East Coast, and it's just looking for food. And that's one of the things that the professor, or the, you know, Elson brings up. He said it's just looking for food. That's why it attacked the fishing ship. That's why it attacked the other freighter. It's going down, just picking up food as it goes. In the end, as we see with other Harryhausen movies, and I'm thinking more along 20 Million Miles to Earth, the Emir in 20 Million Miles to Earth never attacks anyone until it's attacked. It's not a violent creature. It's just an animal. Okay? Much like with, I'm thinking here, a little different than I would say from It, the Terror from Beyond Space, the first episode of Bots, Bugs, and Babes, where we're talking about the thinking creature, where it's coming on because it's looking for food and it's drinking their blood. That's much more intelligent, much more humanoid. This is, again, a creature, a beast, as it's going down there, down the coast. And even when it attacks them underwater, it's just looking for food. It's not truly like thinking that these people are coming after them. It's what it's going for.
Yeah, and the idea that this is a monster is only created in your mind. And that, again, you almost have sympathy for the creature because he's just doing what he was.
Yeah, but he does. I mean, yeah, animals do. I mean, the thing is this. There's a scene in there where they're in the diving bell and you see a shark and an octopus have a fight, right? Which was clearly filmed in an aquarium, especially when the octopus grabs onto the glass, which I thought was always really funny. Even as a kid, it's one of the things that I noticed. But we look at that and we say, okay, like, that could happen in nature. A shark and an octopus could have a fight. Like, it's part of what it is. I think that speaks to, and that's what one of the things Harryhausen likes to do. He always tries to put feeling and more into his creatures. His creatures are, and his creations are never just, you know, killing machines. They're not the slashers we would see in the 80s, the Jason Voorhees and stuff like that. They are just things that are either out of their element. It Came from Beneath the Sea is a perfect example. Our last episode here on the Triple B, where we saw them explode a nuclear war, and it drove it up from the depths. And that's part of what we're seeing when we look at movies like this and giant monster movies. When you start looking at why it's there, and I know a lot of people like to just blow them off as just being kind of whatever the fare might be. When you're looking at why are they doing this? Why are they coming up? And we see this later in the Nature Run Amok movies. I'm thinking Food of the Gods. I'm thinking, Piranha, they kind of make them. But even like Jaws and things like that, it's just, at no point do you think like, oh, it's just, that's what they do. They're animals and they're looking for food. So, obviously, they're talking about all different kinds of dinosaurs here. It's kind of funny. They're flipping through those sketches of the dinosaurs, right? All the different sketches. And they actually were drawings by Charles R. Knight, who is one of the people that Harryhausen claims is his inspiration, besides, obviously, Willis O'Brien and stuff. And Knight actually died in 1953, the year that the movie was released.
Yeah, you know, what is funny to me, when Nesbitt and Lee are looking through the sketches, is that some of those sketches were actually like postcards that you could buy at the Museum of Natural History, and I probably still have them somewhere in my attic. But it was what I wanted to talk about now. I mean, we've talked about the monster, is the characters, Paul Christian. His real name is Paul Hubschmidt, and he was a Swiss actor, and this was he only acted in a handful of movies in the United States. Most of his movies were Italy, Germany, France. And Britain, but this was his only horror or monster type movie. The rest of them were pretty much domestic love movies or dramas or what have you. Paula Raymond was a backup actress in a lot of areas. She did not do many movies. Her biggest fame came on as being an accessory on a lot of TV shows. Obviously, Lee Van Cleef became the icon that Sergio Leone, he was the bad.
Yeah, Angel Eyes.
In Angel Eyes. Yeah. And I think he was in for a few dollars more. And he was also, obviously, he was in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. But The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly really catapulted him into the limelight. And he was able to do Escape from New York.
Yeah.
And whatever. And but last but not least was Cecil Kellaway. Cecil Kellaway had a huge movie career. Well over 120 movies. And he started acting in 1933, and his last movie was in 1970. He was obviously Dr. Thurgood Elson in The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, but he was also Inspector Samson in the 1940 movie The Invisible Man Returns,
mm-hmm.
and he was the Great Sal Vanni in the 1940 movie The Mummy's Hand. So he had two different parts in The Mummy's,
Universal movies.
And then one of his last parts was Harry in Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlie in 1964. And again, when you bring in this old curmudgeon scientist who was dedicated to his passion, which in this case was paleontology, it really lends that air of in the documentary style of being literate. It was just a great hire to bring him in, very similar to Edmund Gwenn in Them.
Well, I think that's one of the things they had said, was that the success that The Beast had. Now, remember, The Beast was filmed for, what, $210,000. It wound up making $210,000 filming. It grossed a total of $5 million, which was great. And then that's what Them was hoping for. They were trying to shoot it cheaper and whatever. And they mirrored a lot of that same idea, having the strong female secondary character. In that case, being the daughter in Them, and here being the assistant here. And making sure they got a name. Now, again, as my dad mentioned, Cecil Kellaway was a face people had seen. He'd been in a lot of things, a lot of movies to that point. So was he, whether you knew him or not as being one of your favorite actors, he had been in a lot of movies. And his face had been in places, so people had known him. In fact, one of the funny things, and then I asked you a couple other things to mention here. One of the funny things is he says, when they're talking about the sea serpents, right? And when he's about 38 minutes into the movie, he goes, "Today it's monsters instead of leprechauns," right? And Nesbitt says to him, "How certain are you that there are no leprechauns?" Well, here's a funny part. Cecil Kellaway played a leprechaun in 1948's movie The Luck of the Irish. Also, he hasn't got mentioned here, and he should, a name that you'll see come up often on this show, and it's actually come up twice already, is Kenneth Toby. He played Colonel Jack Evans here. You might recognize him from It Came From Beneath the Sea. You also might recognize him from The Thing from Another World. This, you know, obviously as the commander there. Ross Elliott, he plays Guy Ritchie in this movie. He's, excuse me, not Guy Ritchie. Guy Ritchie's the guy who was married to Madonna. How about George Ritchie? Let's try the right name. He was on one of actually my brother's favorite movies, Monster on the Campus. Luke loves that movie. Just, I think, for the plaid shirt on the guy. That would probably be the best part of it. From 1958. Also, obviously, Lee Van Cleef, my dad mentioned. But a couple of guys that you might recognize immediately and not know their names. One of them is Frank Ferguson. He's Dr. Morton. You might know him as Mr. McDougal from Abbott Costello Meet Frankenstein, 1948. And King Donovan, that's the psychiatrist that comes from him. He's Dr. Ingersoll. He's Jack from Invasion of the Body Snatchers from 1956, which might be one of my favorite movies of all time. And talk about a movie that did way more with very little. Invasion of the Body Snatchers. There's pods. There's nothing like even crazy there. So those are just going to be. I mean, we didn't go through. That's basically almost everyone who's in this cast. There is definitely one of the things that my dad pointed out when we were little was the police officer who gets eaten, right? Who just stands there. And nothing. And I know this might be stereotypical, but they're in New York. The cop's like, "Screw this, I'm standing." He just unloads the revolver into this thing. Like, somehow, his little service revolver is going to put down this 100-foot-long, 30-foot-tall behemoth, right? He gets eaten. Well, he comes back. Again, he's in the riot squad that comes out later. And he unloads that clip, too. He was not having it. That's part of the great things about this. The one thing that I've always noticed, and the very opening of the movie, it has that kind of whirlpool effect in the front. I was like, it looks like it was going down the drain kind of thing. You know, the very beginning of the movie, that's what the words come out of. And another thing, what you'll notice is, as my dad said, everything's taken very seriously. Everything's there's no tongue in cheek. There's no wink wink at the camera. The little lines here and there, like the leprechaun line, stuff like that, really don't do, and they don't distract from the story. And I think that's the main thing here. When you look at some of the movies that came later with this, because again, Ray Harryhausen's process, we've talked about this, is not a fast process. To just do the animation alone of the beast, you know, walking on the snow, just do anything with the beast took a long time. The final scene, the scene at where, well, it was supposed to be Coney Island. It's not. It was shot in California, but it wasn't. That scene took time because you had to animate the inside of the. They had to shoot the actual thing. They had to animate inside the small one, and you had to do all these different things. And that's part of the problem when you're looking at these movies and why people are like, well, Harryhausen didn't do a ton of movies. He didn't. He didn't do a ton of movies, folks, because each one was its own special thing. Whether we're talking about The Beast and 29 Fathoms like we are today, whether we're talking about It Came From Beneath the Sea, but how about Earth vs. the Flying Saucers? Just the flying saucer work alone in any one scene took weeks to do, because instead of just giving you just something to throw out there, he took his time and he really made sure he was giving you the most out of each scene. And I think that attention to detail, you have people who are taking things seriously, and you have people who really enjoy what they're doing. And again, we've not mentioned here major name actors. This is certainly did not have an A-picture budget, but there's no way you're going to look at this and say, wow, they cheaped out. There's no cheaping out. There's not. You see everything's on the screen. One of the things we were talking about before we got started was some of the scenes in New York City. And I said to my dad, I said, well, the streets are empty. And we probably figured it probably was during like one of their, bombing. New York was not bombed, but I'm saying like the drills, right? You know, the old duck and cover drills. You did that in school. It's because I didn't do it in school. Kind of thing, right? Nowadays, we have to worry about, like a hurricane or something coming through. We had those kind of drills, and we worry about lockdowns and stuff. The street of New York, any street in New York being empty is just a rare thing. And you look there and the shot down the street where you see,
it's Herald Square.
Yeah.
And then,
right. But on the marquee, there's the movie that's playing.
Oh, it's called Detective.
Right. Yeah. Which is a little earlier than 1953. But again, it wasn't like they took shots from the 20s where the cars would be wrong. They had current shots. Things that, you know, there was no substituting Toronto for New York in this film. They got film of New York. And clearly, they're not shooting every single thing in New York, and a lot of it's done with miniatures and stuff like that, but they made sure it was authentic. Why? Because a New Yorker would tell it's wrong. That's one of the biggest complaints you have with movies, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the continuity.
Yeah.
Well, the thing with the shots of New York, I mean, this movie only runs 80 minutes, but there must be stock footage that's at least 10 minutes long in the movie of the airplanes in the Arctic, and some of the scenes in New York. As a matter of fact, when Nesbitt is flown back to New York from the Arctic after he has his encounter with the Rhetosaurus, the ambulance pulls up to the hospital, and the hospital, they call it Hartley Hospital, and that is a can shot of the Hartley Hospital sign outside the gates. That's actually Bellevue Hospital in New York. Yep. And I know that because my future wife was a nurse there. And I used to, when I was dating her, I had to pick her up on Fridays after school to bring her back home. And I remember driving through those gates with my old car back then. The uniqueness of New York is one that if you don't do it right, it looks ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And today, even today, when they substitute a city, you can tell. New York is unique. It's not Boston. It's not Chicago. And it certainly isn't Toronto. Now, Toronto is a nice city, but there are no brownstone buildings going street after street. And when they do show a shot from up high, that's usually a can shot of the Empire State Building, and if it was at the time, if there was the World Trade Center was still there, or the Chrysler Building. But that's it.
Okay. One of the things, actually, there was a couple of things, and I want to go back to one of the things you just said. I just wanted to make sure I mentioned this. We didn't talk about this, but in the trailer actually is different because it has the people coming up in the shadows and talking about what would happen to nuclear, and it's all about what actually happened. And you heard that to open the show. Vera Mills and Paul Persini are two of the people who appear in the trailer, but not in the actual film. And the guy with the glasses, the bespectacled man, was Merv Griffin. And he's actually the announcer also. And if you look at when the guy's announcing, you're like, oh my God, it is Merv Griffin. But to me, Merv Griffin was always old because I only remember him from the 80s and stuff like that. He was much older. But one of the things I actually want to talk about, and you mentioned it right here when we talk about New York, and we've talked about being scale figure modelers, and my dad obviously started building them in the 60s, right? Yep. You know, kind of thing. And I didn't start, and anybody who knows me, and again, some of you may know this, and most of you probably don't, I actually never got into scale figure modeling. Right? I wasn't doing any of that stuff. My dad never pushed it on my brother and I. We helped him build, it was a Rodan and a Ghidorah, King Ghidorah, excuse me, for my EDD folks, which we built together. And we built the gangsters, right, and the cars with the bullets, right? And they're what they are, you know. And Luke and I didn't have paint. Let's paint this thing fast. That wasn't what we ran to do when we were kids. And when September 11th happened, I didn't know how to deal with that. I was up at school in Albany, and once I knew that everyone was kind of down here was safe, we actually did what do you call it? We actually I didn't know too. So I went and bought a model. I bought a Tyrannosaurus Rex model, and I went and bought some paint. And I put, you know, Rob Zombie on repeat, and I locked my door, and I just started painting, and I didn't know what else to do. And we actually came home. I actually came home the day or so after, and what had arrived 2 days before or so was, my dad had the Retosaurus built by Bill Jones, right? Bill Jones is a great artist. You can Google him, see his stuff. He's outstanding. He had actually built one of the scenes, and it's the Retosaurus walking through, destroying a building, and it's clearly supposed to be a New York scene, and Bill kind of brought that to life. So this is one of those movies that when you see this, you know, it has a very New York feel to it, and that's one of the things that I've always associated with this, you know, out of, you know, as you know, small things make, you know, make great change kind of thing. And that's one of those things that the models of the Retosaurus that we have outside, one of them you painted a long time ago. I'm trying to remember. It was just the one you just kind of painted them green. And then I went in afterwards after I thought I knew everything about modeling. And now I can tell you folks, I don't know anything about modeling. And I've been doing it a lot longer. And I went and glazed it and whatever. And we changed it up. And we actually built the scene with you had built the lighthouse.
Well, yeah, we found the lighthouse on one of our sojourns from New York down to Florida. We stopped at a rest stop, and there was a curio shop, and in there was this lighthouse that was probably about the right size. So I just bought it and came back, and then we incorporated it in the scene. We painted the lighthouse pretty much the way the lighthouse
we left. It was the right colors. Yeah, we found one that was the right colors, which was close, the key. Yeah. It was close to the colors, and then you built the sand up.
Yep.
And then we had them standing there,
and we put the sand on a pane of glass that we painted green and blue, so it looked like he was coming in or out of the ocean.
Yeah,
and it works. I mean, as a scene, it works great.
Yeah, I think. But part, yeah, it's just funny though. When I remember doing that, I had been probably modeling at that point for about maybe 2 years or a year, and I'm like, I know everything about modeling, and I just go to, and I look at stuff now, and I'm like, wow, I don't know much compared to some of the stuff we're looking at. But it's again all those things. All those memories that part of all this, and we've talked about this too, and I know, again, some people really look down on the idea that, well, you're making memories from a movie. Look, folks, like, this is what we talk about. You know, and my brother's great idea was to call these Harryhausen the film fantasy scrapbook series. Why? Because the film fantasy scrapbook, which is a real book, there's three different editions. I just picked up a couple off of Amazon using the Two True Frinks link. You know, we look at those. My daughter and I were looking through them the other day. They have great posters, great stills, all different things, conceptual art, and you start seeing what goes into making them, and it leads to discussion. These are movies that we want. I watched this movie. I'm almost 40 years old. I watched this movie forever ago, and I watched it again yesterday on my Blu-ray, and it still just sucks you right in. It's 80 minutes, and it goes by in a snap. One of the other things, when you're looking at these movies in this time and stuff, again, you had your... We talked about our A pictures, our B pictures. This movie definitely was on a B budget. It made A money. And I think that's one of the... Going forward, when you started seeing, you know, people who tried to make things cheaper. This is not Charles Schneer. Charles Schneer, again, and Harryhausen hooked up, as we talked about, on the next film. And then they did a bunch of films together. In fact, culminating with the early 80s, their Clash of the Titans, which was their last one together. You started seeing people realizing they could make money off these things. And when you start looking at, you know, ways... to create art. This is just another form of creating art. Not everything has to be, you know, as we were talking, what was it? It was 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea was released in 1954. And that was Disney. And that took years to make. And it took, I mean, and you had Kirk Douglas in the lead. You had all, you had, you know, major, major funding. It's a color movie. This film was shot in black and white. I don't know if this has the same impact in color. I mean, I've seen the colorized version, which is atrocious. Don't watch it. But I'm saying is, I don't know if this, I think the black and white here really helps sell this as being the time period. And it really brings you in, especially someone who didn't grew up in a time when there was, I mean, we had a black and white TV when I was little, but we had color TVs and we had, you know, movies that were available. We didn't have to wait till the movie came on TV to watch it, you know. And didn't they, the Million Dollar Movie, wasn't that shown, there was the same movie all week?
Was yes, that, it was all week.
So that movie was on all week, and you better see it that week, because if you didn't see it that week, you may not see it again, you know. And that's one of the things Universal got really good at doing, selling their stuff into syndication. Now, this was not a Universal film, so they weren't selling these things into syndication. They just became part of the cycle of movies that happened.
Right. You know, like the statement that you made, you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. I mean, I am not so enamored with horror and monster that I didn't have a professional career. I mean, I worked for years as a financial analyst and as a pricer with IBM, and this was my outlet. I mean, we have had friends come over to the house, and I have a room. It's a big, huge sunroom with just models all over the place. And there are some people that are just fascinated by the creativity that went into actually having the talent to do all of that. And then there are other people that look at it and say, boy, this is a bunch of crap.
Yeah.
And so I say, well, what are you into? You know, and they say, oh, I'm into Renoir. And also, fine, I think that's garbage. So you're entitled to your own opinion. But from my perspective, when I grew up, I grew up in the North Bronx. My two, quote, I'll use the word heroes, were Mickey Mantle in baseball and Ray Harryhausen in the arts. And they shaped my life and what I enjoy doing more than any other people, including any teacher I had, any priest that I had in my schooling. And I went to Catholic grammar school, Catholic high school, and Catholic college. And even to the extent that on my bosses that I had in IBM, only a handful of them really influenced how I came up, you know, came and did my job. And so, for the folks who say that this isn't a worthy endeavor, really rethink your values.
Yeah, I think though too, folks, and this is also one of the things, and I know some of you people got. I would say the tens of people who actually listened to The Vault might have been a little disturbed when they heard that I let Haley watch horror movies with me, and I said, well, she knows it's fake. These movies, like, they hear, and this, and you'll hear this, is that you, from many people who grew up, either who are my dad's age or even people who grew up with these things maybe a little later on in life like I did, this is safe. This is a movie that's very safe for a kid to watch. I mean, it's there's blood, quote unquote, that is dripping in the streets, but it's clearly just a pile of, I'm assuming it must have been tar because it looks shiny, you know, kind of thing. But it's not, there's nothing. I mean, he's eating the cop. It's not like him ripping him limb from limb and, you know, it's being torn asunder. He eats him. He just swallows him up, you know, like no big deal. And so this is not a movie we're going to scare kids. And we've talked about this before. And again, you might think I'm full of garbage, but hey, that's fine. You know, I believe that the more time you spend with your kids, and whether that means, and again, some of you are like, well, Jay, I don't have kids. Well, your niece, your nephew, whoever, like, just don't go down to a school. That would be a bad idea. Just don't show up randomly to school and just pick a kid up. That's bad. I'm saying that's bad now. But the more time you spend with the youth in your lives, you know, getting them to do things that's not plugged in, that's not constantly staring at their phone, that's not, you know, disconnecting from actual human contact. Because why? Because this is the stuff we talk about. Last show, you heard me do my live read for Jersey Fest, which is August 26th, 27th, 28th at the Hanover Marriott in Whippany, New Jersey. If you're interested in that, check out jerseyfestfair.com. That's jerseyfestfair.com. We're going to that this year. My daughter is already super excited that we are going down again. She's coming down on Sunday with her Hellboy model. She loves doing these things. This is important. I know my nephews, my brother is much more a Godzilla guy, and my nephews, they love Godzilla stuff. You know, or any kind of monsters or dragons or whatever. So it's important, though, that you spend time doing those things, because you never can take tomorrow for granted, folks, and you need to make sure that you're making the most out of the time you have. And this is one of those things that we talk about horror movies all the time. We reference these things as we go. Now, some of you might be saying, Jay, I don't own this movie, so I want to pick this up. So, again, twotruefreaks.com, Amazon link, click on it. Takes you to Amazon. Now, so there are several different options. My dad actually pulled out his DVD. It's a snap case. I have the same DVD. Don't buy that. First of all, it's going to run you about $70 to $80. It's not worth spending that kind of money on this because there's much cheaper options. If you want to get it on DVD, and we mentioned this during them, you can get this. You can get Beast 29,000 and them together for $7.94, or the TCM Greatest Film Collection, right? That one, again, is them, it's this, it's a couple other movies. That's $19.99. Now, if you're going the DVD route, to me, it's much better to buy the this with them. Because at $8 for these two movies with free shipping, or prime shipping, excuse me, right, it's great. Now, if you're looking to upgrade to the Blu-ray, and I watched the Blu-ray coming into this yesterday before we recorded, it is pristine. In fact, one of my favorite scenes is the lighthouse. You know, I love when it tears the lighthouse apart. In the Blu-ray, it's so clear, you can actually start seeing all the details that have been faded and washed over the years. By itself, it runs you about $20, $19.98. I wouldn't waste my time with that, folks. Again, you're welcome to do whatever you want. I bought, as we talked about, we actually pre-ordered this before it came out, the Special Effects Collection, which is $36.98. Now, that's got them, as we talked about earlier, Mighty Joe Young and Son of Kong. Those four movies together for $40, a little under $40 for prime shipping, we're talking under $10 a movie. That's well worth your time. Now, some of you might be saying, Jay, I don't believe in getting physical media. I've had people come to my house and look at the thousands and thousands of DVDs that I have and the thousands of DVDs that my dad has and say, well, physical media is dead, which, of course, it's not, but some people, you know, you're welcome to your opinion, and if you're wrong, you can rent this on Amazon Video for $2.99. Now, Amazon doesn't have it yet available to purchase digitally, but let's be honest, folks, is that if you want to find this, it's out there. I would not bother trying to like, well, Jay, I'll just go stream it somewhere. You can try and go find somewhere to stream it. You want to get a good copy. You want to get a clean copy. You don't want one from the old V. Remember the old VHS tapes and how grainy they look? Now, again, the graininess of old VHS, there's a love for me. I actually love old VHS stuff. My brother is even more in love with VHS than I am. But I really like things that are clean because as I'm getting older, the eyes aren't getting any better. That's what I'm saying. You know, so... folks, I'll be honest with you. This is a great movie. I love this movie. My dad loves this movie. My daughter loves this. It is easily a great way to spend an evening. Now, again, only at 80 minutes, you're not killing the night. This is truly not Cleopatra, right? This is no two discs. This is no five four hours. Good Lord! I mean, at the end, you're like, what? You know, kind of thing. But this is a great way to spend an evening, and you know what? It's going to lead to conversations. And as we will see with the rest of the Harryhausens and as we get into other movies, this leads to conversations. This leads to referencing things. The trailer by itself is a piece of work that is something completely different. That's lost nowadays. And I'm not saying they don't make great movies. I'm truly not. What I'm saying is that these kind of movies, these movies made with love for what you're doing, and you can see that love on the screen with not making any money. No one's getting paid millions and millions of dollars here. There wasn't millions of dollars, period. With the budget is $210,000, no one got paid $1 million. No one. Okay, so it's not looking like that. So, as we're moving forward, folks, I know I'm going to give my dad a chance. If he wants, you know, we're going to say our final thoughts and stuff. I know I usually do the live read here, and I know some of you are very disappointed that I'm not doing another Biscuit Basket commercial. Because that is just something else. But what I actually have is some emails, and now you're saying, is people actually emailed you? Yes, there is at least three people who listen to this show. So, and again, I say this on jest, folks. You hear my brother say this. You hear on the vault, we say this all the time because we don't know if anyone's listening to the vault, and clearly people are, because clearly people have opinions that don't agree with ours, and you know, and some of the sophomoricness that occurs from some people not naming names, Chris Hero. So I have a couple emails here to read, and they actually came in right after the first episode when we were filming things. The first one is from Ron Sadowski. Now, Ron plays in the Fantasy Football League, the Two True Freaks Fantasy Football. Now, let me just explain. This is actual fantasy football we play here, not like Dungeons & Dragons fantasy football or like Warhammer. We don't have flying sharks that breathe fire and stuff, although next season we may have to. It, the awesome podcast from beyond Two True Freaks. Ron opens, Jason, just came across the new podcast. It bumped that Earth Destruction Directive show back so I can hear about one of my fondest movies. Glad to see someone is tackling the great backlog of B-movies that form the basics of my youth from the 50s to the 80s. I feel that numerous films that played years after year on late shows and monster movie features on TV helped develop our culture and grounded our generation. Without the common connections, society will fragment more and more. That is why I made my children watch films I enjoyed as a kid. First, it was the material I was familiar with that I knew was age-appropriate, and second, there is always some part of my personal philosophy that was developed through watching and discussing with parents and peers. It's been 30 years since I saw It, the Terror from Beyond Space. I vividly remember the crew having the debate on how to deal with the creature. The solution isn't reached with glee or senses of pride, only out of necessity. In space, no one can hear you morally equivocally. Sorry, folks. It's cracking me up. I just ask that you review films that you and your guests take a look at that stayed with me for years. I'm sure it won't be the effects or even the acting, but maybe a small nugget in the writing or a point of view you had never had before taken it that changed you, just a little bit. I hope that you will charge forward with this endeavor, but not limit yourself to sci-fi or horror. There are great movies from all decades of film, making it in all genres, even giving your years of fodder for Bots, Bugs, and Babes. He went on to suggest a few movies. I just want to just paraphrase some of this stuff. Ron is really on point here. He talked about Teenagers from Outer Space, which he really loved. It's a movie, I think I've seen it maybe once in my life. It's not something he also talks about in the 80s, the direct-to-video craze, and then into the direct-to-video stuff like Starship Troopers 2, Heroes of the Federation. I'm not sure I've seen that one, but he goes, talk about a movie made on no budget, right? And I think it's really important. He talks getting into even the 1940 Sherlock Holmes movies, which were programmers. You know, folks, Bots, Bugs, and Babes is about a love of B-movies. I'm not going to just limit to that. And it's funny, he actually, his little PS here says, glad to hear your first guest is someone you admire and influence you greatly. I think it's great that you're able to get Jesus on your show. But Christ, if he's a no-show, you might want to ask your dad. I hear he likes B-movies too. So, Ron, thank you very much, Ron, for being our first email ever. You can hear Ron on the Dinner for Geeks podcast. And then during the football season, he can just get whooped on by all them Jack and Eddie boys in the league. Sorry, Ron. I think before we get to my second, Luke's actually the second email, Dad. So anything you wanted to add in there? I think Ron's on point.
No, he's on point. I mean, it's exactly what we talked about.
Yeah.
Whatever influences you in a positive way is positive. I mean, you don't have to be a politician. You don't have to be a day laborer. Everybody has their own opinion, and everybody's opinion matters.
Yeah. All right, our second email says, Episode 1, It, the Terror of 68 Minutes. This is from Luke. So hold on. Jay, first off, congratulations on your first episode of the Triple B. You've started down a long, lengthy path where you will inevitably find yourself pouring over an eight-second clip of audio, adjusting and fine-tuning and generally screwing around with it for at least an hour because, dang it, you know how to fix it. This stupid software just doesn't do what you want it to do already. Sounds familiar. It's Terror from Beyond Space is one of those classics which holds up because the premise is so sound. It uses its drawbacks. Namely, the small budget requiring not a lot of sets to its advantage by putting all the characters in a very small space. It's also one of those pictures that is, which is no longer than it needs to be. That's actually a great point, Luke.
Yeah.
You come to see how extended it would be at 75 or even 80 minutes, which just result in this padding and unnecessary subplots. I'd rather watch a lean, mean movie which gets right to the point, and that's what it is, delivers. Looking forward to whatever comes next in the Triple B, Luke. Now, let me just throw this out there, folks. Clearly, it's my brother, so you know, we've spoken about this, and we do joke around a lot. One of the things Luke's speaking about here, making the most of what you have, for those of you who haven't found out that Luke and I like wrestling, here's a bombshell. We love wrestling. And one of the things we talked about, one of the most influential wrestling companies ever is ECW. And ECW, their main thing was, let's hide the negative and accentuate the positives. So, It, the Terror from Beyond Space, you have a very small, you don't have much budget, you're all shot on sets in 6 days or so. So, let's make it really claustrophobic. Movies nowadays try to do that. They try desperately to do that on purpose. They were just making do what they had to do. We looked at them, they they knew full well that they couldn't put the ant out there the entire movie because it made it special when you finally saw it at the 28 when the reveal, it comes over the top of the hill when they're in the desert. When it came from beneath the sea, Harryhausen only had money for 6 tentacles, right? So he hid the other 2. The Beast in 20,000 Fathoms, you're not looking here. They know they didn't have... They went and got the actors who were competent, could do what their job was, and they did the best they could do with what they had. And I'll be honest, folks, this is the kind of stuff we, Luke and I, obviously, you know, and my dad, we've talked about this stuff over and over again. When they were up for Christmas, I mean, we talked about all kinds of movies. It wasn't just horror movies or giant monster movies or Godzilla movies, but we talked about all kinds of stuff. But when we joke around, you know, about being into this stuff, but it's not, this is what we're into, it's what we talk about. We reference these things. This is where, you know, little references come from as you go. I think that's, you know, I mean, Luke was a lot on point there about it being, keeping it under, at 68 minutes, the movie people are like, oh, it's barely a movie. It's exactly what it needs to be. If you start padding a film out, it just starts dragging. I'm thinking again of Cleopatra here at 4 hours. sorry to take a bunch of shots, but whatever, they're not listening. So,
well, you know, some movies need to be that long.
Oh, sure.
I mean, a couple of the classics from the 50s was The Ten Commandments and Ben-Hur. Both of those movies are well over 3 hours. I think Ben-Hur is almost as long as Cleopatra. But yet, when you watch that movie, it goes very, very quickly. Cleopatra, on the other hand, when Caesar, which is Rex Harrison, is killed at the end of the first half, just shut it off because the rest of it is just long, tedious garbage.
Well, but the problem, Ten Commandments was actually longer. It was called the 15 Commandments originally, but he dropped one of the tablets coming down.
Oi.
Oi.
For you folks, that's from
History of the World, Part 1, Mel Brooks. Yeah, see what I'm saying, folks? This is the kind of stuff we talk about. Most of you hopefully got that reference, but some of you are like, what are they talking about? This is what happens. All right, the last note that I've got so far, this is the third email. It says, welcome from Beyond Space, and it's from Jack Bone, who I know writes into my brother's show all the time. It said, just a note to say I'm listening. Don't have much to say about It's Terror from Beyond Space that you haven't said. I was disappointed when I first saw it, the movie that inspired Alien. Is a tough reputation to live up to. That's 100% true there. And he goes on. I first heard of it when a letter writer to Starlog magazine, made the comparison soon after Alien, and the editors even ran a picture of it, meaning It's Terror from Beyond Space, with the letter. When it came around again later, I was able to enjoy for what it was. I thought you were about to hit a pet peeve when you mentioned computer graphics. The Turner Classic Movies hosts seem to make a point to introduce special effects movies of the 30s, 40s, and 50s by stating the obvious that no computers were used. I guess for science fiction films, you could say that filmmakers demonstrate that in that their weird, wildest imaginings that they didn't conceive of using computers to generate images. It was a relief that you weren't just repeating a cliche, but actually had a point to make. I'm going to cut it right there. I'm going to get back to this. That's exactly the point. And I said that in the first episode, in the It episode, I had said, was that there's no computer graphics here. That I had compared it. It's like, this isn't the new Star Wars film. We just seen the new Star Wars film and stuff when we recorded it, which is, I love. You guys don't have to agree with me. It's fine. I loved it. It was great. But I think, and that's one of the things that I think when we were sitting with Steve Wang, it doesn't seem that long ago, but it had to be, what's like 2-3 years ago, right?
2 years ago.
When we said it, I said, what are you going to do with this? And Steve Wang, I said, look, I love to marry the two things together. And I agree, folks. There are plenty of times when digital effects are used. If nothing else, Mad Max Fury Road, which was up for the Academy Award and stuff like that, which I thought should have won because I thought it was fantastic, they use physical effects. There are guys on poles until they could not use physical effects anymore. At some point, you have to have a car flying through the air that's on fire spinning. It's just really hard to film that. So what George Miller did, is push it as far as he could, and then he went and used CG where needed. Jack continues, maybe you could take a look at CG back when there was the C stood for cartoon. Although, besides a few Dracula transformations in the late Universals, I can't think of any that use in a feature, but in serials. Kirk Allen as Superman flying, which is, again, very, very famous, or Captain Video's ship in space. Even the mechanical shapes are not as convincingly done as in The Last Starfighter. Oh, wait! The B-movie on an A-movie budget, Forbidden Planet, which is very famous for featuring that. Yeah. The animation by a more expensive crew wasn't used to cover a failure to achieve a practical effect, but to show an energy creature, some fancy energy ray effects and enhance the physical effects of the C-57D landing. Looking forward to hearing more, Jack. Now, I know Jack definitely appreciates his mecha. I've heard some of his stuff he's written into my brother over the years, and actually, I know he enjoys those kind of things. We're definitely covering these kind of things. Forbidden Planet, I'll be honest with you, Forbidden Planet's one of those movies when you're a kid and you're like, oh, I want to sit down and watch this movie. And then you realize this is not really a kid's movie. Okay? Which is kind of funny because when you think Forbidden Planet, again, it has Robbie the Robot on the cover, and you have the id, which is what you see, the electricity. That creature, which is very in there very briefly, it looks awesome. It's done very differently as it is animated as a cartoon, but it's truly not a kid's movie. It's a talkie movie, and it's sci-fi at that time, and there's nothing wrong with that. But when you're seven and you're like, well, I want to see monsters, you're not seeing monsters here. Okay, you're better. In fact, when we show that sometimes, we talk about this on channel, which was our channel 5. It was what, WNYW, which was before it was Fox. They would show movies, and they would show like a kung fu movie, or and they would show a martial arts movie. You probably shouldn't call it kung fu. It would show a monster movie. Like that's where you would see your Universal programmers. You would see like Son of Dracula or Creature of Black Lagoon or something. Never Creature of Black Lagoon. They didn't ever show that. We waited forever to see it. But they would show Forbidden Planet. You're like, oh, Forbidden Planet's on. All right, great. And you sit there, you're like, what are we watching here?
Yeah. Jay, that reminds me of in 1968, my brother and I went down to New York City at the Lowy's State, which in those days, you used to have to send away for tickets, mm-hmm. and they were called road shows. Oh, yeah. And they would play the movie as a matinee. And then as an evening show, Monday to Friday, and then Saturday and Sunday, they would play it three times. And we had gotten these tickets because I was looking so much forward to seeing 2001: A Space Odyssey. Mm. So this is going to be great because when you saw the trailer on TV, there was this monolith, and they had the monkeys. And when my brother and I went down there, we're still looking for a 2001 book for dummies. Because it was one of the most boring movies we've ever seen, and the ending was so surrealistic that you say to yourself, "Okay, let's go get something to eat," yeah. because this movie, this thing was a disappointment. And to this day, if it's on like TCM, I don't even own it on DVD because I just can't sit there and watch it. Yeah. It's just too boring. Now the follow-on movie, 2010. was done much better, and that movie I can sit and watch because at least they explain things as they go. But 2001 is just like Forbidden Planet, a great premise, a lot of anticipation, but in reality for me a disappointment.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people, and this is something Luke's touched on this, and I have too, especially on the Vault. Forbidden Planet's a movie like, oh, that's a great movie, and they may never have seen it. 2001, oh, that's a classic, that's a great movie, and have you watched it? And that's what we ask people. Now, you don't have to agree with us, folks. That's the whole point. If you don't agree with what my dad just said or what I said or whatever, send us an email, tell us you don't agree. That's okay. Everyone's entitled to their opinions. Okay, the idea is this, though. Those are not the movies that we necessarily sit down and watch. I'll be very honest with you. The other day, I actually ordered... they sent me the wrong thing. They sent me just Frankenfish. I was trying to get Piranha 2. But you say to yourself, who would watch that garbage? Well, I'll tell you right now, folks. Again, I'm looking for something that's fun. I don't always look for the movies that are super deep. The Academy Awards actually just occurred this year. Well, it was Spotlight won, yeah. won Best Picture. Now, I'll be honest with you. I may watch Spotlight one day, but I certainly was not chomping at the bit to get the DVD. But then the Hunger Games, again, I know some people are not fans of the Hunger Games. The new one's just been, when we're recording this, it's just been released. My wife and I love those movies. My parents love those movies. We're going to sit down and watch that. Now, some people look at that and they say, but Jay, how can you like that movie when the Hunger Games is just a ripoff of Battle Royale, which we know. But again, they're 2 hours apiece, those movies. Those movies aren't short.
Right.
And in fact, Catching Fire, Mockingjay, the last one. Catching Fire is the one, the book that was the best. But Mockingjay, the book was relatively short. They made a 4-hour basic movie out of the thing. At no point you're sitting there going, this is boring. Like, they definitely put it on the screen. You're seeing, now whether you like the story or don't like the story, you're entitled to that. But it's saying is, it's the kind of movies that I enjoy. And that's why, when Mad Max Fury Road was up for the Academy Award, and I knew it wasn't going to win. It won Best Sound, it won Best Costume, it won all these things. I knew it wasn't going to win Best Picture, but Man, that is a great B movie. It's on an A budget. It's an A budget. And George Miller, yes, who, you know, the same guy who made Happy Feet, you know, you look at his thing, he made the Mad Maxes. He put everything out there, and but you're seeing the budget. It's not like you're wondering, like, wow, I wonder who got paid millions and millions of dollars to be in there. Charlize Theron was great in the movie. I thought this version of Max is a little different. I think we've discussed this off the air, a lot of stuff we talk about, how this Max is much more, he's not the main focus, that this is truly Furiosa's movie, which is outstanding. It's one of those things that when you look at a movie like that, it's a B movie, guys. And I know you're thinking, like, a B movie can't be there. But let's be honest, I mean, there was a little movie known as Gladiator. Let's be honest, Gladiator's a B movie. You don't have to agree. Again, you don't have to agree. It's a B movie. It's a sword and sandal movie. Jay, but there's a deeper story. Yeah, Ridley Scott made it. We got it. Ridley Scott's awesome. Okay? But what I'm saying is, Gladiator's a B movie. Look at the other movies that Russell Crowe was involved in that won Academy Awards. I'm thinking of A Beautiful Mind. A Beautiful Mind is an A picture. A Beautiful Mind is, it's a drama. I mean, it's all the stuff goes into that, the mental, he's insane. I mean, like, yeah. Right? Or even the Inside Man, which is the other one that went, I mean, Russell Crowe made some good movies. And again, you don't have to like Russell Crowe. I do. But Gladiator's a B movie. Yes. Is there really good writing? Yes. Is there really good acting? Yes. And whether you like Joaquin Phoenix in his role, whether you like any of the people, it doesn't matter. The whole point is that movie took the country and really across the world by storm. And people are like, this movie? When you saw the original trailer for Gladiator, if you remember the Super Bowl from that year, and I remember who played in that Super Bowl, could have been the Rams in the greatest show on turf. I don't remember.
2000?
I don't remember who it is.
Oh, it was 2000.
But it wasn't the Giants. It's all that matters.
It was the Ravens and the Giants.
No. The Gladiator came out. The Christopher Gladiator. No, because I watched the Ravens. I watched the Giants lose to the Ravens.
Right.
I was in grad school. This was the 99 okay. Going into that Super Bowl. Whatever it was, it doesn't matter. The Giants weren't in it. And if they didn't win, and it just hurts anyway. It's okay. It could be worse. You could be a fan of the Jets. So the whole point is that we watched the original commercial for this show, because you do play doing a commercial. They would show parts of Gladiator. Then they would show, like, football players. And then it would show, like, hi. I'm like, what are they selling? And I thought it was for a sports drink, right? And then by the time you got to the actual Super Bowl, then they started showing the Gladiator commercials to the point where I would have tears in my eyes. Like, this is so, I have to see this. My buddy Mark and I, senior year, Mark was a discus thrower and a football player. I did shot and disc jab, hammer, 35-pound weight myself. We went and saw it opening day, first show, 10 a.m. on a Friday, because we didn't have Friday classes because we were seniors. And we sat there, and it just floors you. And you're thinking, well, Jay, that's an A picture. It's not. It's truly a B picture. Sword and sandal movies. Now, I'm trying to think. Like Demetrius and the Gladiators Those kind of things were bigger. Kind of, they became bigger than they were. What am I thinking? Ben-Hur is the major one. Ben-Hur was a major A picture.
Well, The Robe was the first one. That was 1951. Sure. And then Demetrius and the Gladiators was the follow-on film. And The Robe was kind of boring also. That's with Richard Burton. But Demetrius and the Gladiators, now you bring the gladiator fighting into the picture. And so in many, many spots, you've got action. And yet it's a movie about the finding the robe of Jesus Christ, and there are some great scenes in there.
Sure.
where the Roman emperor gets a hold of the robe, and he has one of his servants killed, and he puts the robe over him, says, rise, and obviously he doesn't rise. And those are the things, those are types of scenes in movies that hold your attention. But the thing with Gladiator to me was, I mean, when the boys Jason and Luke were home, even on break, we used to watch wrestling all the time. And the Gladiator, when the first scenes of Gladiator, or the first knowledge of Gladiator was coming out, was being shown on the WWE and the WCW channels.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so I didn't think anything of it. I thought it was going to be, you know, like the movies that you see nowadays that have the wrestlers in it, that they were going to don loincloths and helmets and swords.
Yeah.
And instead of wrestling, they were going to fight.
Right. It's kind of like the Rocks, the movie, the Hercules movie. And then I forgot the guy's name, the big guy, Kellen Loden or whatever his name is, the Legend of Hercules kind of thing. Remember that the two Hercules movies came out? That kind of movie where they're just sword and sandal. They weren't, the writing wasn't there.
Right. And then when, as Jason just said, once they showed the trailers on NBC, CBS, and ABC, and they weren't on the wrestling channels. Now you're seeing some, wow, this is really, this could be something. And Russell Crowe, I mean, he wasn't a household name at that time.
He had done, he'd done Mystery Alaska was his big movie before, the hockey movie.
Right.
And he was in there, yeah. But he wasn't a name.
Well, he also was the rogue cop in L.A. Confidential. And,
but I'm saying, but he wasn't a name.
No,
that movie was a Guy Pierce film. Yeah, right. Yeah.
No,
yeah, and yeah. Well, Guy Pierce is in it, and it's also Kim Basinger. They have the main roles.
They have two main roles.
Well, Kevin Spacey's in it and stuff. Again, that's an A picture right there, you know, kind of thing. L.A. Confidential was an A picture, that kind of thing. So he was a heavy or one of the backup play in an A picture. To make him a star in this, Ridley Scott makes movies Ridley Scott wants to make. I think he's made that very clear over the years. And this is going to, we're talking about Gladiator now kind of thing. But I think what we were noticing is when you see that, he had good writing, there was a good story behind it, and Ridley Scott's name attached to something gives it an air of, yeah, this is a qualified thing. But what did Ridley Scott, see what he started making? He wasn't making these pictures when he started making a remake basically of It, the Terror from Beyond Space. He made Alien. Okay? I mean, seriously, that's a B movie. Alien is the B movie that scares you so bad that you may... Well, not... I'm saying... Some people are like, it's not scary. I dare you to watch the ventilation scene in the dark. Don't watch the middle of the day. Watch the ventilation scene where he's in there and it pops up right in front of him. You will jump. And I'll be honest with you, the chest burster scene might be the most effective scene in the entire film for scares. But since it's been satirized, Spaceballs I'm thinking of at the end and stuff like that, it's been done so much it's known. But again, folks, again, think what happened here. We've now talked like this is almost like when I started talking about Jersey Fest last time. You get me on something I like to talk about, we start going. So I want to wrap things up here, folks. The Beast in 20,000 Fathoms, a movie that I love, a movie that my daughter loves. And this being the Father's Day episode, I mentioned this. Clearly, this is a movie that has influenced. My dad showed it to my brother and I were real young. It's one of the movies that's very influential for me. My daughter has seen it. She loves the trailer just for being able to say the beast, you know, so kind of thing. She's definitely, kind of coming into that, and she likes her own stuff. She likes playing Disney princesses, fight Godzilla, and then they all kill each other. It's great. You know, that's the living room sometimes. And then she plays school. So, but it's important though that you're taking time to, make sure that, you know, you spend time with your loved ones. And to be honest everyone kind of takes things for granted, and then when you know something bad happens, like, oh, I should have done more. Don't ever say you should do more. Just do it. My daughter, and she's 5. She drives me nuts sometimes, but at the end of the day, I love her to death, and you know, I spend time with her and do all kinds of things. We read together every night. We spend time drawing. We're writing. She makes cards for everybody, tell how much they love them. She tries to, you know, we're working on her spelling and different things like that. Though that's all quality time you'll never get back. So, just want to throw a happy Father's Day out there to all the fathers out there, anyone who might be a father figure in your life, someone who stepped up, you know, and that might be, it's one of those things. As a dad myself, my life changed very much when my children were born, even more so than when I got married, or even more so than, you know, any other event in my life. My children have changed a lot of that. So any last thoughts here, Dad, on The Beast, wrap this all up?
No, I think we've covered quite a bit. I do have one little last snippet. And it has to do with the difference between special effects back in the day and special effects now. When you watch, like, and a good example is the two that we've just done the podcast for, them and The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. The soldiers that are firing the bazookas.
Oh yeah.
Okay. there is definitely something going on at the back end of the bazooka, because you see the big puff of smoke come out. But if you watch closely, nothing comes out the front. Nothing comes out the front. Not like today, where you see the shell in slow motion, you see it ripping the hide off of whatever creature or human that they're firing at. But that always gets me. And then there was one other scene in the movie when Nesbitt is talking to Lee before they go through the sketches.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He takes a bite, a small bite of the sandwich. It takes him 2 minutes to finish chewing. Now, that's good hygiene, but it also means that it was poor editing.
Yeah. Well, it's also him flirting.
Yes.
He's, this sandwich is yummy. And he's like, God, this is horrible. What is this, Vegemite? You know, kind of thing.
But other than that, Jay, those were just two things that, I'm a continuity person. I love to make, when scenes flow together. I mean, the last thing I like to see is a scene where the glass is half full, then it's empty, then it's full, and it's the exact same
The head
scene.
On the beer is always gets you. The head on the beer always gets you.
Yeah.
Because they fill the beer, and the thing is, you know, obviously if you're using the big head on the beer, the no head in the beer, big head in the beer, not in this film, but I'm saying in general, that always, my dad's like, look at that, what's going on there? And I was like, you're willing to accept everything else. You're willing to accept that the aliens came here, but the head and the beer changed. That's just continuity.
Yeah,
I understand.
I mean, it's not just one genre. It's just something when you watch TV, especially TV shows or movies that are made for TV, it's just a pet peeve of mine. But again, this show is all about The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, a great movie. And as Jay said, if you can find it on Blu-ray, it'll make your day.
Yeah. And all right, folks. So the thing is this, what are we going to talk about next? Now, I know my dad has been on. Now this is going to be the third episode in a row. And so, you know, again, I've been lucky to have him guesting with me. The next movie we're covering, I don't think my dad is going to be on. I think this is going to be one of the ones where it just might be me and by myself, unless someone really wants to get in on this. It's going to be 1978's Piranha. Now, before you start saying Piranha, it's Roger Corman. This is a B-movie podcast. You knew it was coming, okay? And I'm starting with a movie that I really like. And you know who else likes that movie? You know who else? Steven Spielberg. Yeah, he likes that movie. You know why? Because he told Universal, don't sue him. I like it. It's good, okay? So you don't have to agree. It's fine. I'm talking about 1978's version. Let's make sure we're all on the same page here. Not the 1995 remake, which I just bought, by Roger Corman that he made for New Concord Pictures. Not the 2000-whatever... The Piranha 3D, which the scene where Jerry Connell's stuff gets eaten and then regurgitated, which is, it's again, nothing wrong with either of those films, although 95 is not so great, but the we're talking about 1978's Piranha, right? We're talking about Lost Lake. We're talking about time to get in there. It's part of the Summer Sizzler series, if you want to go wrestling style there. And folks, I tell you, it's been a lot of fun talking to my dad here doing this today. I like having a good time here. If you can obviously tell that I'm, you know, enjoy what I'm doing. And folks, I tell you, it's great to have feedback from you guys. Again, if you want to email the show, you want to get in touch with us, you have questions for myself or my dad, that's botsbugsbabes@gmail.com. That's botsbugsbabes@gmail.com. It'll also be in the outro of the show. You can hit me up on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. I've been posting a lot of pictures of stuff I've been doing, working on. Model wise, especially getting ready for Jersey Fest, because as you know, I like Jersey Fest. So, anyway, folks, all this stuff we've gone through today, I know we've hit a bunch of stuff and rambled a little bit, and we're running a little long for us, but obviously, we're having a good time. We're enjoying what we're doing. We need to hear from you guys. Hit us up. If you have suggestions, we'll gladly read them. If you have, you know, something you think we were doing, something we missed on, something like that, gladly hit us too. So, as I say, keep those cards and letters coming in. Keep watching the skies.
Happy Father's Day.
The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms was also a beast from prehistory and from an old friend's imagination.
And Ray said, would you mind coming over and meeting my producer? The producer gave me a copy of the script they're working on and said, we need your help. Maybe you could help rewrite this for us. Would you mind reading it? So I went in the next room, read it, came out. They said, well, what do you think? Can you help us? I said, yes. But incidentally, this story of yours is very much like a short story of mine that was in the Saturday Evening Post 2 years ago, The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. Well, the producer's jaw dropped, and I realized they had taken my story, forgotten where they'd taken it from, and called me in to rewrite it. So I didn't have to say anything. I didn't make a fuss. The next day, a telegram arrived saying we want to buy the rights to The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. And that's how the film got made. And I was walking along the shore one night, and I came upon the ruins of the old Venice Pier and the serpentine spinal cord of the roller coaster. And I said to my wife, I wonder what that dinosaur is doing lying here on the beach. And the foghorn blew in the night, that following night, and I sat up in bed and I said, of course, the dinosaur on the beach had heard the foghorn blowing, thought it was another dinosaur, swam for an encounter, discovered it was a foghorn and a lighthouse and destroyed it and died.
In the film, he had to live on for a few more reels.
It was a short story, so there wasn't enough material for a complete feature.
In the expanded screen story, the Rhetosaurus eventually makes his way to New York. Like most provincials, he didn't know how to behave properly in the big city.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters, or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman, or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at twotruefreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
This has been an episode of Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-Movie Podcast. If you'd like to contact me, please email the show at botsbugsbabes@gmail.com. If you'd like to find me online, I'm on Facebook under my name, Jason Giaconetti. I often contribute to the Two True Freaks Facebook group. You can visit my Facebook page, The Art of Horror Collective, and you can search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective. On Instagram, find me under my name, Jason Giaconetti, and search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective, as well as the new hashtag Bots Bugs Babes Podcast. I'm the only one using them. I'm also on Twitter at Jason Giaconetti, and you can visit my webpage at www.theartofhorrorcollective.wordpress.com. All movies, characters, stories, music, etc., are properties of their respective holders. This is a fan work, and any use of any property is purely for review, discussion, entertainment. So don't sue me. I ain't got anything anyway.
There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow!
Will you stop?